and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, best-selling author of Last Child in the Woods and The Nature Principle, Richard Louv, as part of the Conversations About Causes That Matter series presented by the Anchorage Parks Foundation in partnership with the Alaska Community Foundation, Richard's talk entitled Connecting with Nature in a Virtual Age was recorded on Thursday, September 6th at the Get Outdoors Share Fair in Anchorage. Former Chancellor of UAA, Fran Ulmer, provided the introduction.
Thank you very much. Welcome. Welcome to UAA. And welcome to this exciting lecture this evening. It's my pleasure to have the opportunity to introduce Richard Louv. Before I do, I would like to tell Richard something about you, something about us. You are educators, scientists, professionals who specialize in getting people out and enjoying the out-of-doors. And you are people who love being outdoors. You love living the big wildlife. You love the fact that you live in a city that ranks number one in the United States for the number of acres per thousand people. You love the fact that in this city, we are so close to the big wildlife that we feel a part of it, unlike many people in our country and in our world who are increasingly disconnected from nature. I grew up in a small town in Wisconsin. I was really lucky because I was literally right next door to the Horicon Wildlife Refuge, where I got to see birds and beavers and all kinds of people enjoying this special place. That changed my life forever. What can we do to make sure that more children in America have that experience? I don't think it's something that a lot of us have given as much thought to as we need to. I serve on two boards, the National Parks Conservation Association Board and the Nature Conservancy Board, and at both of those boards, we have a lot of conversations about the fact that a lot of people my age and older are committed to conservation, but that we're not doing as much as we need to raise the next generation of advocates for conservation. How do we do that? Richard Louv has an important part of the answer to that question, because it's the personal experience that children have, that teenagers have, that people of all ages have, that give you the spiritual connection to nature that makes you a lifelong advocate for parks, for conservation, for clean air, for clean water, for organizations that support those things. So I'm thrilled that Richard is here tonight. As you probably know, he has written many books, including the famous book, The Last Child in the Woods. He gives lectures. He is a thought leader. He inspires people to take action. So before Richard comes out, I just want to encourage you to take action. What are some of the things that you might consider doing right here in Alaska to build that next generation of young people who can benefit physically and spiritually and in many, many, many ways by just getting out in nature? Well, number one, I think we can all support organizations just like the organization Get Outdoors Anchorage Coalition. We can find ways to volunteer and support efforts that they are undertaking to build the park constituency. We can give comments to the Alaska Environmental Literacy Plan that is being developed in a way that will make certain that preschool through 12 in our public schools will be incorporating environmental literacy as part of every child's experience in public education. And we can buy copies of this book and give it to young parents. Young parents who maybe are feeling very overwhelmed by a lot of other advice, but for whom this very simple piece of advice of getting out of doors with your kids can be transformational. Ladies and gentlemen, we are honored to have a person who not only gets it, but advocates for it. Please welcome Richard Loof.
Thank you, Fran. I really want to thank you for bringing me here. I've had a great time. I was just in Fairbanks. I heard you had a windstorm, and I missed that. I've met so many wonderful people here. Last night there was a crowd similar to this in Fairbanks that they're getting ready to be loud. They're getting ready to start some kind of campaign, a network there in Fairbanks. They're looking to Anchorage as an example, maybe to team up with Anchorage. And I understand the new name of Get Outdoors is now Get Outdoors Alaska, that you're taking on the whole state. And I hear this is a big state. So, Kathy and Gillette and all the folks who helped organize this, I just a debt of gratitude. Let me start by saying a confession. I'm sure you used to see in PowerPoint. I don't do PowerPoint. I hope that's okay. I did PowerPoint twice. And this was a couple of years ago. The first time I did it, I did everything wrong. Too much information on every slide, all of that. The second time I did it, I cleaned up the PowerPoint presentation. I thought I was doing great. I was out in front, and I was clicking away and talking to everybody and going over everything that was I knew was on those slides. And I was up there for quite a while before I turned around and realized why everybody was paying so much attention. My screensaver had gone on, and it was picture after picture of my wife and I on a beach in Mexico. And she looked really good. So I haven't done PowerPoint since. Let me start actually with an Alaska story. When my younger son was in high school, both my sons love nature, but they're a little different. One is now 30, and my younger son is now 24. My older son is a little more focused on urban things, but he notices things about his environment. He first lived in New York, now he lives in L.A., that I think he has been sensitized to, even in an urban environment. As he told me one time when I was visiting him, and we went for a long walk in Central Park in New York City. We walked for like 5 hours in the park and just talked. And he said, you know, Dad, when I walk through the old neighborhoods of New York and Brooklyn, I love those old neighborhoods. And the way he described the weathering of the brick, et cetera, it clearly he was very much tuned in to the habitat of humanity in a sense. He was sensitized to what is around him. And he said, Dad, I get the same feeling walking through the old neighborhoods of New York City that I used to get walking with you in the canyon behind our house. So he deals with nature a little differently. The younger boy, and Jason, by the way, the older boy, he'll fish with me to humor me, and he's a good sport about it. The younger son, Matthew, I knew he had the fishing gene because when he was 3, I caught him fishing in the humidifier. So I'll tell you the Alaska story. So a few years ago when he was in high school, I brought him to Kodiak. We were in the fly fishing club, and he was giving me one of those looks, like, this doleful look, because there was a ticket to Saltery Lake Lodge that was half price being raffled off. And I wasn't going to do that. And then I looked at him, and I looked at him. He was, I think, 13 or 14. All right, so I did it, and I got it, to my chagrin. And we flew up here, and of course I got the wrong date on my on the whole thing, so we had to last minute redo the flight. So we had this experience on Kodiak that had then led to us coming back three more times to that lodge and fly fishing there. He, like, came home. He just was stunned by it. And we had a lot of encounters with bears. And one day we were going up a stream, a narrow stream, and the guide taught us how to smell for bears. Now, you all are very familiar with bears, I'm sure. You know, you have to do everything you're not supposed to do when you fish. You make a lot of noise. You talk. You sing for bears. The title of the chapter, the first chapter of The Nature Principle, which is the new book, is called Singing for Bears. So we were going up the stream, and he taught us how to, the guide taught us how to smell for bears. And I'm sure some of you smelled that smell. It's this peculiar odor that's a mixture of bear musk and rotten salmon, because they like to roll in it. And they don't sell that at Nordstrom's, I don't think. The guide said, once you've smelled that, you'll never forget it. And if you smell that when you're up here, that means one of two things. Either the bear is right there in the bushes next to the stream and you can't see it, or the bear has just left. Being able to smell bears is a very useful talent. My son's comment was, this sure beats high school. I got home. I thought that was really neat to be sensitive. I got home and learned about a study that had just been done using college students as guinea pigs. And they had put blindfolds on them and put things in their ears so they couldn't hear or really see well. And they could track by scent through the woods quite a ways. And the study suggested that human beings have a little bloodhound in us, that we're able to do that. And we've forgotten that we can do that. One of the things they observed was that the college students just naturally, as they followed the trail, did what other mammals do that do follow trails by scent, which is they zigzag. At least they think that's why they zigzagged. They were college students. But they followed the trail, and they could follow it. It was amazing. The people who study, the scientists who study the human senses, no longer study just five senses. They no longer talk about just five senses. They talk conservatively. This is falling off. They talk conservatively about as many as 10, and actually many of the scientists talk about as many as 30 human senses. Such as the study about being able to track with your nose. But there's also echolocation. Human beings have some capability for that. And people who have lost their sight have begun to learn how to use a rudimentary echolocation that bats use. There's a whole set of these senses that are just fascinating. And mainly what we do in modern society is block them out. When we're focused on a screen, no matter what our age, if we're a kid, if we're an adult, if we're focusing on that screen, we're doing a lot of work just to focus on that screen, to ignore the other incoming information from around the room or outside the window, etc. When I was doing the writing the Nature Principle, I kept thinking, what is this I'm really writing about? Now, Last Child was particularly about children. The Nature Principle moves over into adults and then offers a kind of vision of what a society might be like if our days and nights were as filled with nature as they are with technology every day where we live, work, and learn, and play. What would that society be like? But I talked about adults and kids in the new book. I kept wondering, am I just talking about health? Is that it? Physical health, mental health? That's a big topic in terms of the influence of nature on our health. After a while, I realized, no, there was an overarching theme, which is, what does it mean to be alive? What does it mean to be fully alive? And are we fully alive? when we spend our days and nights plugged into one electronic medium after another, blocking out those senses, as many as 30 senses. Are we allowing our children or encouraging our children to be fully alive? Are we fully alive? Those senses are so important to us. I think that we should begin to focus on the full use of the senses when we talk about education. When we talk about education reform, etc. The new studies that have been coming in are quite interesting. Many of them are done about children, and many are done about adults. And a lot of them have come in since Last Child in the Woods was published. Just a few weeks ago, there were studies published by the University of Kansas that looked at young people backpacking. And they factored out the aspect of just the exercise and what that would do for people. And they reported that just 3 days of backpacking, when those young adults came back from that, their cognitive skills had improved remarkably. And that was the word they used. And their creativity, and they measured this in some fashion, had improved by 50%. It seemed to be that after 3 days, the impact of that peaked. So it spiked there at 3 days. So 3 days is the optimum for backpacking if you want to get more creative. But many other studies have come out suggesting the same thing. As many of you know, the symptoms of attention deficit disorder in children get much better with just a little bit of contact with nature. The people doing those studies at the University of Illinois, they're not out in rural areas. They're studying kids in the projects of Chicago. And they're finding that just a walk through trees in a park has this impact on these kids. The people doing those studies suggest that nature therapy be added to the other traditional therapies for attention deficit disorder, which are behavioral modification and Ritalin and other stimulants. I would ask the question I did in Last Child in the Woods is, could it be that at least some of the huge impact, the huge increase in the number of kids that are being prescribed Ritalin and other stimulants, the number of kids that are being diagnosed with attention deficit disorder might have something to do with the fact that we've taken nature away from them in the first place? You know, could it be that at least some of the huge increase in the number of kids, little kids, being given antidepressants might have something to do with the fact that we've so radically changed childhood? Could it be that the suicide rate among teenagers might have something to do with that? I was in San Francisco one weekend, and I picked up one of those magazines you find in the hotel room. You always wonder where they come from. And the back page of this one magazine had a black and white photograph. It's a beautiful photograph of a little boy on a beach. And he's racing along, and his eyes are filled with life. And the story next to the picture said that this little boy had a problem. This little boy couldn't sit still in the classroom. He had the wiggles. He was disruptive in class. The teachers finally had enough, and the kid was kicked out of school. Now, the parents, of course, were distraught at that. But they were good parents. They'd been observing very carefully what stimulated their son. And they had already realized that being out in a natural environment helped their son calm himself and focus. So for the next 10 years, they took their little boy to all the great national parks, etc., in the West, great natural areas of the West, and the little boy turned out okay. The photograph was taken in 1906, and the little boy's name was Ansel Adams. So here's a question. What if they had taken little Ansel and put him in a chair in a cubicle called a classroom, told him to sit still, given him pharmaceuticals, canceled recess, canceled field trips, made him live in a neighborhood where you couldn't step on the grass because of the CC&Rs, the covenants and restrictions, etc. What if they had done that to little Ansel? And maybe even put some screens in front of him 54 hours a week, which is now the average, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, the average amount of time a kid spends in plugged into some kind of electronic medium is now 54 hours a week. What if they'd done that to little Ansel? Would we have the gifts of nature that Ansel gave us, that nature gave him? Would we have the support that we now have that is a little fragile these days for the national park system that Ansel Adams' photographs encouraged? Another question is, how many other little Ansels and Anselettes are out there right now who could give us great gifts if we give them the gift of nature? Now, I'm not a radical on Ritalin. Some kids need some kind of medication. That not everybody agrees with that, but I think that some kids do. But what proportion of that huge increase? What are we doing? What are we thinking? And yet this research has been coming in, even as this disconnect from nature continues to deepen. This research is saying that our kids can become smarter and happier and healthier if we get them outside into nature more. Some of the other research that has come out, it's hard to check them when the computer falls off, the thing slides off. The studies on health, on physical health, there's actually more research on mental health than there is on physical health for adults and children on this. But physical health, research released a couple years ago, University of Indiana, University of Washington, and Purdue, showed that the neighborhoods that in dense urban neighborhoods, those neighborhoods that are the greenest, the child obesity is less in those neighborhoods. And what was very interesting about that study is they found that that was independent of population density. In other words, you can have a very dense neighborhood in terms of number of people live there, and still have this effect. Now, you can have different kinds of green neighborhoods. You can have green roofs. There's a lot you can do even within dense neighborhoods through design, et cetera, that can really help with that. So the presence of nature, even in a passive sense, helps with child obesity, which, of course, is a huge problem. It's not a panacea. We don't really know at this point the complexity of what causes child obesity and what causes rise. I mean, we have some common sense suspicions. You know, if they grow up on couches watching TV, that might have something to do with it. But I realize that it is more complex than that. There are other factors. Obviously, diet is part of it. Maybe genetics, etc. But if you've got a population growing up under protective house arrest, you're probably going to have kids that are a little heavier. Actually in 2010, I was asked to be the keynote speaker for the National Conference of the American Academy of Pediatrics. There were 3,000 pediatricians and pediatric nurse practitioners and others in the audience. I was pretty nervous because if there's one group that can get to parents and are trusted by parents, it's pediatricians. My wife knew I was nervous because she took my face in her hands right before I left to get on the plane to go to San Francisco from San Diego and said, she's a nurse practitioner. She said, listen to me, Rich. Pediatricians are different from other doctors. They're really nice people. So, of course, I led with that when I talked to the pediatricians, and they liked that. So I was off to a good start. But here's what I said to them. I said, here's what I'm not going to ask you to do. I'm not going to ask you to have an official policy on nature deficit per se, because I know you're going to ask for the 30-year longitudinal studies. And here's what I have to say about that, pediatricians. Where the hell were you 30 years ago when you should have started those studies? Why has this been so ignored until quite recently? Now, later I learned why they were understanding, in a sense, of what I was saying. I learned that pediatricians every day prescribe drugs that have never been tested on children because of the rules on how you can test these drugs. You can't really test things on children as you can on adults. So they already know that there's a certain amount of art in what they do. And this idea that everything has to be strictly evidence-based has a few holes in it when you start looking at it more closely. So here's what I said secondly. I said, here's what I am going to ask you to do. I'm going to ask you to use your own best wisdom and individual judgment to take care of the kids the way you see fit. And if that includes writing a prescription to nature, please do so. And I understand you're doing that here. This is beginning to catch on. The response to my speech, I was a little less tired than I am tonight, so I was a little more dynamic, I guess, because I got a standing ovation and then 250 pediatricians lined up. Oh, well, thanks. that wasn't fishing for that. Maybe fly fishing. 250 or so pediatricians and others lined up and to get their books signed, and many of them said they were going to go home and change their practice. Now, it's not because of that speech, not because of a book, because this was building anyhow. But what you're doing here in Alaska in terms of pediatricians writing prescriptions or recommendations, I think the word recommendations is preferred by many doctors because of somehow a prescription has to do only with drugs, apparently. And I understand you've created a prescription pad for pediatricians or all physicians. And I think that's terrific. We have one on the Children and Nature Network website, too. Maybe it's the same one. It is, okay. And but today, there are a lot of pediatricians and other physicians beginning to write prescriptions to families, to kids, to go outside, go to the park. Some of the park districts around the country call these park prescriptions. In Portland right now, and maybe you have something like that here, but in Portland right now, the urban park district there is working with the local physicians, I think mainly pediatricians, who write these recommendations or prescriptions. When the family gets home, the park district calls them and says, here's what we can do for you. Come to the park on Saturday. Family goes to the park. The park rangers, now acting as park health paraprofessionals, a new role that they really like, help the family get their green exercise in the park. Then they sign off on the prescription. It goes back to the pediatrician. Over time, they're going to study to see how this does. And I would suspect that they'll find it has good impact. So things are beginning to change. There are a lot of good things happening now.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Richard Louv, author of Last Child in the Woods and The Nature Principle. His talk entitled Connecting with Nature in a Virtual Age was recorded on September 6th at the Get Outdoors Share Fair in Anchorage.
The Children and Nature Network was created after Last Child in the Woods came out, mainly because I was overwhelmed suddenly, unexpectedly, by a lot of requests, okay, so what do we do? And I had made the mistake of saying in the last chapter of imagining a movement to connect kids to nature. So now people were calling me on it. And so some very wonderful people kind of came to my rescue, and we formed the Children in Nature Network to encourage a movement which has emerged. which was latent, which was there before. Lots of people were working on this a long time before I came along. Some of them are here tonight. But suddenly there was a lot of activity. And one of the things that started happening is exactly what's happened in Anchorage. I would go into, not that I did this here, but I would go into a city and give my sermonette, and lots of groups would come together. Many times they had not talked to each other before. They all go to the same funder sometimes. But they would come together to bring me there, and then when I left, they would look around and they say, well, we've got the beginning of a network here. We've got the beginning of a coalition. And then they would keep at it. One of the first was in Cincinnati, and it's a citywide campaign. In the beginning, they called it Leave No Child Inside Cincinnati. And then they thought about that for a while. And they changed the title. I think they put a comma in there or something. But it's doing great things. It's working with pediatricians, it's working with nature centers, it's working with the schools, etc. There are now, I think, 100, this number keeps changing, going up. I think there's 109, last time I checked on the Children and Nature Network website, regional, statewide, provincial campaigns in Canada, in the United States and Canada. Some of these are smaller, some of these are really big, some of these are statewide, as I said. And there's a peculiar nature to these campaigns. I didn't understand when I was writing Last Child in the Woods how powerful this issue was in terms of bringing people together. These campaigns that have emerged, and perhaps you've experienced this here, they get people into the same room that don't want to be in the same room. Real early, I learned that it doesn't seem to matter what somebody's politics or religion is. They all want to tell me about the treehouse they had when they were kids. If they're old enough to have had that treehouse, the younger they are, the less likely they are to have any kind of experience like that. But they all wanted to tell me about that. Left, right. There's a chapter near the end of The Last Child about the spiritual necessity of nature. I was very careful with that chapter because I know that this is a dangerous area. That's why I put the chapter at the back of the book. Maybe people wouldn't read that far. But I was very careful with that chapter. It's a very touchy issue because there are people who, and I respect their point of view. I don't agree with it, but I respect it, who worry that somebody like me is going to come along and try to get their kids to worship nature. Now, I don't do that. But they do. I was still worried, even though I was careful. I gave the chapter to a very conservative Christian friend of mine who read it, and she's quoted in it. I really did want this book to bring people together, not drive them apart. But I was still worried. I got no flack at all. None. One of the first champions of the book was the president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Very conservative guy, has his own radio program, etc. Very well-known guy. I even got asked to be on the 700 Club. Pat Robertson's on the Christian Broadcasting Network, his show. You mentioned Martin LeBlanc, who came here earlier. To speak. He's on the board of the Children Nature Network. At the time, he was head of all youth programs for the Sierra Club. And when he heard that I was maybe going to go for a taping of the 700 Club, he said, "Don't go, Rich. It's a trap." And I said, "No, I got a good feeling about this. I really do." And I went and I taped the interview in Washington, D.C. And I was all puffed up. I thought I'd done a great job, you know, and I walk out on the on the sidewalk in Washington, and I look down, and I realize that my zipper has been down through the entire Christian Broadcasting Network interview. You know those moments when you realize your true position in the universe? Yeah, that was one of them. But they did a good job on it. They really did. They did a great job. Pat Robertson even commented on it. So not long after that, I think I was in... I was in D.C., and I gave congressional testimony. This was early. This is a Interior Appropriations Subcommittee. And there were seven congressmen there. They were all men. Congressmen there. I'm told that's a good turnout. And there were three of us who gave testimony. One person was the head of the Nature Conservancy nationally. One person was the chief biologist for BioServe, which tracks endangered species. And then there was me. Now, the other two guys came first, and they both had PowerPoint presentations. So I figured I was a goner in terms of any time left. But they made some time, so I gave my little sermonette. Afterwards, the congressman asked a few perfunctory questions about acreage and species. And then all they could talk about was remembering their special place in nature when they were kids, and you couldn't shut them up. They went on and on. And in those moments, there were no Democrats in the room, and there were no Republicans in the room. There were just these seven men with a shared memory, and they didn't want to be in the last generation to have that type of memory. I often talk about my special place in nature, my own, and I'm sure that most of you are here tonight because you had a special place in nature when you were kids, and it was your place, and you owned it, and it owned you. Mine was the woods behind my house. I grew up in Raytown, Missouri, which is a suburb of Kansas City, Missouri, on the suburban edge. I could go out my back door through the hedge, into the cornfield where my underground fort was, and then from there on into to the woods and the fields and the farms that seemed to go on forever. Those woods in particular were my woods. They're still in my heart today. And I sometimes go to those woods where I find something I don't find anywhere else. Now, I had such a sense of ownership of those woods that as an 8-year-old, I pulled out hundreds of survey stakes that I knew had something to do with the bulldozers that were taking out at the other woods. And I think I held them off for a while. I had a developer tell me a couple of years ago that I would have been a lot more effective if I'd simply moved the stakes around. But they were my woods. Now, I tell that story often. I told that story in Albuquerque, New Mexico, to a group called the Quivira Coalition, which is a really interesting organization bringing together ranchers in the West and environmentalists, and they're doing land trusts, et cetera, together. And it's interesting because it really brings the political spectrum together, people who care about the environment, et cetera, that some might dismiss as tree huggers. But there's also these ranchers who care not only about the nature, but about the ranching lifestyle, and they want it to continue. So there are about 500 people in the room, and half of them had cowboy hats. And I told that story, and afterwards in the Q&A, which I hope we'll do here in a few minutes, a rancher stood up, and he was the real deal. His jeans had not been acid washed. He had thick plastic rim glasses, you know, like this, and a white handlebar mustache, and he was sunburned. And he said, "You know that story you told about pulling out survey stakes?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "I did that when I was a boy." And then he began to cry in front of 500 people, half of whom were wearing cowboy hats. And despite his deep sense of embarrassment, he continued to talk about his sense of grief, that his might be one of the last generations to have that kind of sense of ownership of land, and it has nothing to do with money. This goes deep in people. This goes very deep. Not long after the book came out, I got an email from a developer. I can never remember the name of this company, but I was told it was the biggest privately owned residential development company in the country. And I was pretty hard on developers, both as a newspaper columnist and in the book. But he wrote me and he said, I just finished reading Last Child in the Woods, and I found it very disturbing. And then he said, I want to do something about this. So he invited me to Phoenix, where they had a meeting of about 80 developers and real estate folks. He asked me to give my spiel. I did. I prepared to run. And then he did something remarkable. He said, I want you all to go into small tables, small groups at the tables, and I want you to solve the problem. How are you going to build residential developments in the future that actually connect kids to nature? The developers, et cetera, went to their tables, and the room filled with noise, happy noise. Now think about that. These are developers, happy noise. And then they came back and started reporting their ideas. And some of them were pretty good, like maybe we should leave some natural land. You know, good place to start. And maybe we could have, maybe we could put a little nature center right there in the middle of the community, and it could help parents deal with their fear, et cetera, and we introduce kids to the native species. Maybe we could have walking paths through the neighborhood that would go to the schools, and you could have kids along the paths, kind of like crossing guards, except they'd be nature guides with cell phones. And then maybe we could market these things as amenities. Now, it didn't matter to me the quality of their ideas, and some were more good. What mattered to me was that they had them, and they were excited. Clint Eastwood, not long after that, brought some of the biggest developers in California together at his Carmel Ranch, and he didn't talk to a chair that time, by the way. And he was there, and a guy with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, who's a friend of his, had talked him into doing this, brought me in to give my spiel, and these really powerful developers, and the same thing happened. They got all excited. And I'm thinking, you know, if that can happen in a room full of developers who were really sincere in this, and then the recession hit and they couldn't do anything, but what can happen in other rooms, in other groups in our culture? If this issue has that power to bring people together, conservationists at the same table with developers, at the same table with pediatricians, at the same table with educators, the same table with mothers and fathers and grandparents and ranchers and fly fishing guides. What else could happen? And that is happening. This is emerging. What you're doing here is happening elsewhere. The main thing I want to tell you is you're not alone. There are thousands of people working on this now, and I think it's starting to pay off. There are recent studies that have come out of, for instance, attendance at national parks. It's not true of all of them, but apparently the 15-year slide of attendance at national parks, which was going down so far that the people who run the national parks, and one of them, the former director of the National Park Service, is on our board of directors, were very worried that there was going to be any political support left for national parks in not too many years. Apparently that's bottomed out and started going back up. There's a report that just came out a couple weeks ago from the outdoor equipment industry, I think. I can't remember who did this study right now, but it showed that, and the quote went, that the decades-long drought in people buying fishing licenses and hunting licenses was over. Literally, I mean, I don't know if you've seen that in Alaska, but in many states, this was dropping to the point we were starting to wonder whether those activities were going to die. They're starting to go back up. There are other indicators. We did an independent study of all of these regional campaigns like yours, and it was funded by the Kellogg Foundation. It was done independently. We didn't do it. And they found that in 2009, we did two studies, one study and then a follow-up 2 years later. In 2009, campaigns like yours across the United States and some in Canada had gotten about a million kids and youth into nature. 2011, it was 3 million. They're seeing more and more pediatricians involved. They're seeing more and more acceptance in the broad community of this idea. This is having an impact. There's a study released just a few weeks ago by the Nature Conservancy nationally. They did their own poll. And this is where I need my notes that are falling off the podium there. And they found that, I think the figure was 82 or 83% of Americans now think that the sedentary lifestyle for children and children not going outside is a, quote, serious, unquote, problem. This is the second time in a major environmental organization study that that issue has ranked above climate change. In fact, in this Nature Conservancy study, I'm a little suspect of the way they did it, but in this Nature Conservancy study, the sedentary lifestyle and kids being disconnected to nature was up there at the level of the budget deficit in terms of how serious people thought it was. So whether we're near the tipping point or not, I don't know. But I do know that the work that you're doing and that you're going to do is going to preserve at least a core of people, of children, that will go outside and will not lose their memory of what it's like to live in a society in which that's considered not only the norm, but expected. And you won't be in the last generation to have that experience. Now, some of those studies, when they're reported, the recession is credited, that there's some great value change going on in society because we have less money. And they talk about, you know, how families that are not going on European vacations anymore, they're going on staycations in the local park. I'm not sure what proportion of Americans actually take their kids on European vacations, so I'm a little suspect of those statistics or that view also. But oftentimes journalists immediately go to that, and I would suggest that yes, that's part of it, but you're part of it too. And the people like you all over the country, now all over the world. I just got back from Australia. This issue is huge in Australia. The whole Western Australia, which is the biggest state in Australia. I don't know if it's bigger than Alaska. It probably isn't, but it's huge. They've just created a Nature Play, WA, which stands for Western Australia campaign. They're doing amazing things. I just got back from Sydney. Where they're doing something similar involving the national parks. So this is happening quickly and all over the country. Cultures can change pretty quickly. Remember the anti-smoking campaign. That happened virtually overnight. The big change occurred. Not everybody agrees with that campaign, but you have to agree that change is possible. The last thing I want to talk about, and then if there's time, I hope we can have more of a discussion, is the way we think about the future, the way we talk to ourselves and our children about the future. Not long after the book came out, I was asked to go speak to a high school near where I live. And I didn't want to go because I was just back from traveling. I was tired and grumpy. And then I started thinking, I wrote this book, it's my own community of kids, and I started feeling guilty, so I went. Now, when I walked into the auditorium, I expected 20 kids, but there were 200. They'd been given extra credit. I talked for an hour, and you could have heard a pin drop. And it's not because I'm a great speaker, I'm not. As you can tell, I wander around a little bit. But they listened. They were on the edge of their chair. And I talked about two things. I talked about the fact that their health, the full use of their senses, their full ability to feel and be alive, their mental health, their physical health, could be enhanced by a little more time spent outside in nature. The second thing I talked about is, because of climate change, whatever we want to call it, and other major environmental issues that are associated with that pollution, et cetera, whether or not somebody believes in climate change, these problems exist. Because of the severity of those environmental problems, everything in the next 40 years must change. We'll need new kinds of agriculture. It's already happening with organic agriculture, et cetera, et cetera. We'll need new kinds of architecture and urban planning. It's already beginning. And I'll talk about that a little later when we have the discussion. We'll need really kind of a new society, one that is as immersed in nature every day as it is in technology. Now, when the kids left, I turned to the biology teacher who had invited me. And I said, what was that about? Why were they paying so much attention? Didn't expect that. And he said, easy answer, Rich. You said something hopeful about the future of the environment. They never hear that. Now, I might have listened a little more closely to my younger son, the fisher, the angler. Because around that time, he had started saying things like, you know, Rich, how they, Dad, you know, Dad, he's not saying Rich yet, good. He's saying, you know how they sliced off all the hills across the lake and replaced that with development? I said, maybe that's nature too, because it's made out of wood. And I said, that's a good discussion to have. You got a point. But he kept saying things like that. And finally, I sat down with Matthew and I said, Matthew, what are you thinking about? What is this related to? And he said, his exact words were, and his voice broke when he said them, Dad, when I think of nature being destroyed, it's too painful to think about. It's too painful to think about. So my own son was beginning to create a worldview that would cause him less pain by accepting the destruction. I just came back from I'm on the book tour that never died since 2005, but I did a book tour within the book tour for the paperback of the Nature Principle. I talked at several colleges and universities, University of Utah and Columbia University, Purdue were three of them. And at one of them, I think it was Purdue, I sat down with some students. They took me to lunch. These were environmental studies students. And they said that they couldn't get with it with the major environmental organizations. Some of them said they'd gone to meetings of some of these organizations, and they just couldn't connect, partly because everybody was old. And I have to tell you that one of the very biggest environmental organizations in the world, headquartered in the United States, I'm not going to tell you which one because I don't want to embarrass them, the average age of their membership is 67 years old. The average new member is 64. They've not been doing a great job of bringing in young people, and they know it. And that's one of the reasons why they're on the wagon. They're really connecting with this issue of disconnection and control in nature. Also, I was in Toronto on that tour recently. And you know who David Suzuki is? For those of you who don't, he's like the number one environmentalist in Canada. He had a television series that ran on PBS, The Nature of Things, I think was the name of it. And he's one of the icons of Canada. And they had me come up there, and they had this event where they called a conversation with Richard Liu, with David Suzuki and Richard Liu. And we sat in front of several hundred people. And he said this remarkable thing. He said, 20 years ago, people came to me and said, David, you ought to spend more time focused on getting kids connected to the natural world. And he said, no.
"We don't have enough time," he said. And then, on that stage with me, he said, "That was one of the biggest mistakes I've ever made in my life." And that's why he's so supportive of the kind of work that you all are doing. Those students that took me to lunch, the environmental studies students that said they couldn't connect, there was a girl, a young woman, in at lunch with us. And she was a very hip young woman. I knew that because she had a lot of tattoos. And she said this remarkable thing. She said, "I'm 20 years old, and all my life, I've been told that it's too late when it comes to nature." I'd never thought about that before. Most of us here had some years, even decades, to build up some kind of resilience, some kind of alternative vision of the future, maybe. We had a chance, at least. And she said, "All my life," and of course, 20 years, "all my life." So the despair that we seem to be addicted to is affecting people. That's the flip side of all of this. I've become convinced, and I understand there's a little science that might even back this up, that most Americans, when they conjure up images of the far future without being rational, without sitting down and being studious about it, the images that are most likely to come to their mind about what the far future looks like are images that look like Blade Runner, Mad Max, The Hunger Games, a post-apocalyptic future in which nature has been stripped from human life along with our humanity. Now, if I'm right, and if those are the major images that pop into people's heads about the future, then we're in even more trouble than we think. You know the slogan, "Be careful what you wish for, it might just happen." Be careful what you imagine, it might just happen. We have to have an alternative vision. The best we can come up with right now basically is a robots are us future. It's not very satisfying. Or we just survive. We just sustain. I have trouble with the word sustainability. I still use it. I don't have a better one. Because I think it suggests to most people stasis, breaking even, surviving. We weren't put here just to survive, I don't believe. We were put here to create. One of the things I often have said over the years is that Martin Luther King said and demonstrated in many ways that any movement, any culture will fail if it cannot paint a picture of a world that people will want to go to. His speech, as others have said, was not called "I Have a Nightmare." And I'm not saying, I'm a journalist by trade, and, you know, I'm allergic to happy news for happy news' sake. But we've been missing a big part of the story. All the possibility to create not just an adequate society, not just a sustainable society. You know, William McDonough, the great green architect and green designer, says, "Do you really want a sustainable marriage? Don't you want something better?" Now, I know a lot of you would like a sustainable marriage. But really, don't we aspire to something much better? If we don't aspire higher, we won't make it to sustainability. So I think we need to begin to paint that future. That's largely what the Nature Principle is about. I think people are just starved for that. So I'll stop here and we can have a discussion. Thanks.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Richard Louv, author of Last Child in the Woods and The Nature Principle. as part of the Conversations About Causes That Matter series presented by the Anchorage Parks Foundation in partnership with the Alaska Community Foundation. Richard's talk, entitled Connecting with Nature in a Virtual Age, was recorded at the Get Outdoors Share Fair in Anchorage on September 6th, 2012. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.